gentlemen, can I have your attention, please? Welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. My name is Ernst Herrmann, the president, still the president for a few weeks. And in civilian life, I'm the correspondent of Finanz und Wirtschaft, this is a Swiss newspaper. I'm going to make a couple of requests and announcements. Actually, one request, please turn off your mobile phone. Second, we're going to have tonight another event. It's quite, our kitchen staff works very hard. It's a big one as well. We have Sundra Mantagori. He's an art dealer as well as an art historian. He will talk about 100 years of modernism in Indian art. That's today at 7:30. For those who booked the original scheduled event, thanks for the patience. I think most of you showed up except of one or two exceptions. Many more actually signed up later. Welcome. Then an apology. Unfortunately, today's guest could not be joined by a speaker, as we hoped, who talks about the Chinese government's policy in regard to Tibet, as hoped. This would have been an interesting dialogue. Welcome this very much, this occasion. Some news value. But we still hope that at the later stage we can schedule a speaker who currently lives in Tibet itself or is a mainland specialist on Tibet. At this moment, we of course welcome Kate Sanders at her own at the FCC. Kate is Communication Director of International Campaign for Tibet. She's a writer and lobbyist who for over 10 years is specialized in monitoring the situation in Tibet, a part of the mainland where visits by foreign journalists are widely restricted, as we know. Her articles have been published in newspapers and magazines worldwide, including the Washington Post, the Independent, and the Sunday Times magazine. Kate worked as a senior news analyst for Tibet Information Network prior to joining ICT, gathering news from the field in India and Kathmandu, briefing governments on human rights issues and providing information for the mainstream media. Kate, the floor is yours.
First of all, I'd like to thank my hosts here at the FCC for defending the FCC's tradition of free expression on all issues and declining to cancel this talk despite some pressure to do so. Thank you all too for your interest being here. It's an honor for me to speak at the FCC. Perhaps I should also thank the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs too for their contribution to promoting this talk. I wanted to speak to you here in China about Tibet direct. I did try to speak also to press in Beijing, but was not granted a visa. A few weeks ago, I was even called into the Chinese embassy in London and asked if I had heard that the Dalai Lama had incited the riots in Tibet last year. When I responded on this point, I became aware that my chances for being granted the visa were slipping further and further away. Beijing has sought to dominate the debate on Tibet and to silence all discussion that does not conform to the state's point of view. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs' objections to this talk are another example of the government's relentless efforts to cover up its repression in Tibet, which is currently undergoing a violent crackdown following a year of overwhelmingly peaceful dissent against Chinese rule. I'm privileged to be able to speak to you here in a way that Tibetans cannot. The MFA described me as a separatist who is not welcome in Hong Kong. It's not surprising. Anyone who disagrees or even expresses mild concern about the Chinese government's position is generally classified as a separatist. Article 103 of the criminal law in China sets forth the crime of inciting separatism and harming national unity, which can be interpreted by the authorities in Tibet as a call for the Dalai Lama to return, or display of his image, or display of the Tibetan flag. And this can be punished by torture, by imprisonment, or even, as we've seen in the last year, by being shot dead. China frames discussion about Tibet as one of sovereignty, claiming that the country's territorial integrity is threatened by a separatist movement supported by foreign hostile forces. The Tibet Autonomous Region Party boss Jiang Qingli spelt this out recently when he said, "Our struggle with the Dalai clique does not involve questions of nationalities, religion, or human rights. It is a struggle regarding the maintenance of national sovereignty and territorial integrity. No target is too insignificant nor too powerful to escape China's censure and aggressive diplomacy on this point." Sarkozy is the latest world leader to have kowtowed to Beijing's demands to acknowledge Tibet's lack of independence in a joint France-China communique. It was surely not a coincidence that this was published on the same day that Sarkozy sat next to Hu Jintao at a banquet last week, the G2 dinner. The UK, as well, had sought to recategorize its historical relationship with Tibet in a statement a few months earlier, even apologizing for not doing so before. In recent months, China has subverted and politicized international forums scrutinizing its human rights record. It has refused to answer legitimate questions from governments about the use of lethal force against unarmed protesters. It has failed to provide any sort of accounting of the detention and sentencing of those in prison since the wave of protests began last year. At a time when media outlets internationally are making serious cutbacks, Hu Jintao's administration is spending around $7 billion to boost overseas propaganda, including the establishment of a 24-hour English language all-channel news model modeled after CNN and the opening of more Xinhua offices across the world. CCTV in the People's Daily looks slicker and more contemporary than before, but it does not change the fact that all information on state-run channels must reflect the government's official view. Together with the propaganda offensive, in recent months, the Chinese government has hardened its policies against the Dalai Lama and Tibetan culture and has implemented increasingly rigorous measures of silencing Tibetans. Beijing has called upon support for the Dalai Lama to be crushed, and with the People's Daily announcing a few weeks ago that people should, and I quote, "firmly crush the savage aggression against the Dalai clique, defeat separatism, and wage people's war to maintain stability." A new campaign in Tibet against so-called rumor mongering signals a more systematic and hard line approach to Beijing's cover-up of the crackdown. This effectively means that any expression of Tibetan identity not directly sanctioned by the state can be branded as splittist or reactionary and penalized with a long prison sentence or worse. The Tibet Autonomous Region Propaganda Bureau Chief Kai Yuying made it clear that it is not only an offense to spread rumors, but also to listen to what people say in a statement recently. In recent months, Tibetan pop singers, artists, writers, musicians have been detained or have disappeared under a new drive against cultural products with suspect ideological content, such as songs referring to the Dalai Lama. In music bars, Tibetan performers are no longer allowed to address the audience as Tibetan brothers and sisters because it is considered, and I quote, subversive to the unity of the nationalities. A meeting was held recently by the National Level Working Group in Tibet on smash mischievous rumors and correct wrong views. Incidentally, that meeting was coordinated by the Tibet Autonomous Region Coordinating Committee of the Smash Mischievous Rumors and Correct Wrong Views. Officials during this meeting made it clear that personal views and thoughts fall within the purview of this campaign. And one senior official also talked of the need to monitor phone calls. His comments were followed by the arrest of a Tibetan female cadre in her 30s, Norzin Wangmo, who was sentenced last November to 5 years in prison for passing on news over the phone and internet about the situation in Tibet to a friend in America. Monasteries and nunneries in Tibet have long been regarded by the authority as being at the front line of the anti-splittist struggle. But the confrontation over patriotic education and denunciation of the Dalai Lama Some of them wept as they recited long life prayers for the Dalai Lama. After a standoff, dozens were arrested and the rest obliged to return to their monastery. Although on this occasion, the police were clearly under orders to use restraint, this did not last for long. Tibetans are paying a terrible price for their courage and determination. One of the key characteristics of the past year has been the high number of disappearances across the Tibetan plateau. And by Tibet, I'm referring to the Tibet Autonomous Region and Tibetan areas in Chinese provinces of Qinghai, Gansu, Sichuan, and Yunnan. So Tibetans are being taken from their homes, often in the middle of the night, to unknown locations. And their families literally do not know if they are alive or dead. Some Tibetans in Lhasa have told me that it reminds them of the period of the 1950s and the 60s and 70s during the Cultural Revolution, when people were taken to do hard labor in the Gulag in Qinghai. In April last year, hundreds of monks were taken from the three major monasteries of Drepung, Sera, and Ganden, many with black hoods over their heads, to a military camp in Qinghai, where they were held until the Olympics was over. None knew how long they would be there, and their families had no idea where they were. According to an extrapolation of Chinese statistics, more than 1,200 people in Tibet remain unaccounted for. We've put together a list of more than 600 names of Tibetans we believe to have been detained since March 2008, but the real number is likely to be far higher. On New Year's Eve, in the Western calendar, a Tibetan writer, Wosa, who many of you will know about, she's become one of the most authoritative and respected voices since the protest began last year. She lives in Beijing with her Chinese husband, Wang Lishong. She's been described as the Tibetan writer who forgot to be afraid. She's been documenting almost daily what's been happening in Tibet. On New Year's Eve in the Western calendar, Wosa wrote this in a blog. I'm reminded once more of what a friend in Lhasa says only when drunk. You don't just greet each other with the Tibetan greeting Tashi Delek, which means good fortune. When there is no good fortune, what we should be saying to each other is be careful. Friends in Lhasa are telling me that every night you can hear dogs suddenly start barking incessantly, and you can't help but be terrified. Terrified that your door will be kicked down by state security, terrified that you'll be locked away in the night for some unknown crime, terrified that your loved ones or yourself will disappear like vapor. I've heard this told to me again and again in a whisper, and it saddens me so deeply. What consequences will this terror bring? The Chinese government has sought to represent the unprecedented unrest across the Tibetan plateau over the past year as solely one violent riot, referring only to the events of March 14th in Lhasa. For weeks after March the 14th, state-run television showed selective footage of monks apparently hurling rocks at police, protesters destroying shop fronts, and plumes of black smoke being from burnt-out cars in Lhasa. A DVD of the so-called 314 incident has been produced and circulated by Chinese embassies to diplomats all over the world. State-run media focused on the deaths of 18 Chinese civilians and one policeman in the March 14th riot, but it also sought to suppress the news of Tibetans who were shot dead or tortured to death during the crackdown. Over the past year, the Chinese authorities, in one single statement by one official, have only acknowledged three deaths that have occurred in Tibet over the past year. When the Tibetan government in exile released video footage two weeks ago, showing the beating of Tibetans in police custody and the death of one young Tibetan following torture, China blocked YouTube, where the footage had been uploaded. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Qing Gang was asked about this at the press briefing in Beijing last week, and he proved himself a master of doublespeak when he gave this answer. The internet in China is fully open, and the Chinese government manages the internet according to the law. As for what you can and cannot watch what you can watch, and don't watch what you cannot watch. Following the outbreak of the protests last year, the Chinese leadership immediately blamed the Dalai Lama and the Dalai clique. A Chinese party official even characterized the Dalai Lama as someone who is directly engaged, and I quote, in the evil deeds of separating the motherland by means of beating, smashing, looting, and burning under the disguise of a Lama and under the signboard of Buddhism. This approach has derailed the dialogue process that had been underway, if without substantive progress, between the Dalai Lama's envoys and the Chinese officials. Tibetan writer Wosa referred to the language adopted by the Dalai Lama, by the authorities on the Dalai Lama, when she said, "It is like the dagger revealed. It was the unmasking of the true face." The leadership still fails to acknowledge in any way Tibetans' genuine grievances with Chinese policies, depriving Tibetans of rights and of freedoms. Beijing simply stepped up the hardline policies that had already failed in creating the social stability that Hu Jintao says is evident in Tibet. This is accompanied by a propaganda offensive focused on persuading a domestic and an international audience that the situation is normal and that Tibetans are happy. Ultimately, the emptiness of the rhetoric and the efforts taken to persuade the center and the Chinese people are indicative of the party's anxiety in controlling Tibet. While Beijing seeks to portray itself to the world as a 21st century emerging superpower, its language in Tibet is reminiscent of the paranoid excesses of the Cultural Revolution. The reality is that this is the only period since China's takeover of Tibet in 1949-50 when protests have continued despite the severity of the government's response. State repression and the government's position on the Dalai Lama have created deepening tension in Tibet, while distorted nationalist propaganda has dramatically increased divisions between Chinese and Tibetans. As Tibetan historian Sering Shakya points out, the authorities' representations of what has happened in Tibet over the past year have also undone decades of rhetoric in China about the unity of the nationalities and the harmony of society, as well as creating divisions between aggressively nationalist and progressive Chinese citizens. Some Chinese lawyers, intellectuals, writers, and others have taken considerable risks to express their support for the Dalai Lama. Some Chinese lawyers offered to defend Tibetan prisoners in trials after protests, while others signed a petition complaining about the stepped-up nationalist rhetoric and seeking support for the Dalai Lama. Tibetan resistance is about the right to have a voice, the protection of a unique cultural identity, the ability to practice a religion that is based upon the principles of wisdom and compassion. These are freedoms that, in the words of one Tibetan writer recently, are seen to Tibetans as unattainable as stars in the heavens. But most of all, Tibetans have risked their lives in the past year to convey the message that the Dalai Lama represents their interests and not the Chinese state. As one Tibetan friend told me recently, uneducated Tibetan farmers, nomads, even school children who have risked their lives in the past year do not necessarily understand the concept of independence, even while they're calling for freedom. But what they do know is that they want the Dalai Lama to return and to come home, and they've called for that again and again over the past year. Some have lost their lives or faced unbearable torture as a result. The Chinese authorities can remove pictures of the Dalai Lama, and they can ban songs with metaphorical references to him, but they cannot remove his presence in people's hearts and minds, and they will also find it difficult in the long term to deal with the resentment that this evokes. If the Dalai Lama passes away in exile, generations of Tibetans will not forget how the Chinese state sought to extinguish his influence and block his return to his homeland. The prospects for reconciliation and genuine stability in the region would inevitably be much more uncertain as a result. Tibet is not yet China's Gaza. Despite China's representations, the protests that have swept across the Tibetan plateau have been overwhelmingly peaceful. Tibetans have made great efforts to convey the message that they are following the non-violent approach of the Dalai Lama, an approach that is embedded in their culture. I don't know if any of you saw the video of the Tibetan nomad horsemen early on in the protest last year, charging towards a town and raising the Tibetan flag, taking down a Chinese flag. One Tibetan nomad who was watching that with me said, do you notice that none of them are carrying any guns? Normally in these areas, Tibetan nomads would often carry guns in order to protect livestock against predators. But they'd made a very strong point of not doing so for that protest. There's been a new initiative that we've seen being developed by some Tibetans in recent months, although we don't know how widespread it is, and it's called Pure Wednesday. Participants in this are striving to be a pure Tibetan every Wednesday. Wednesday has long been a sacred day for Tibetans. It's often marked in Lhasa at the Jokhang by burning incense. It's known as Soul Day in Tibetan. It's linked to the Dalai Lama. But in some areas, a more strategic form of resistance is being adopted, which involves Tibetans on this day only wearing Tibetan dress, only eating at Tibetan restaurants, only shopping at Tibetan shops. In some ways, it does seem as though the Chinese authorities' crackdown has served to strengthen Tibetan identity and a sense of solidarity across Tibet. For instance, despite China's attempts to enforce celebration of Tibetan New Year, or Losar, in February, Tibetans across the plateau chose to define this significant festival for themselves. In the words of one Tibetan, they did so by remembering the dead and praying for the living. Shops were shuttered, parties cancelled, and Tibetans failed to attend official government performances. As a Tibetan friend said to me last week, this has never happened before in the history of Tibet. The Tibetan writer Wosa illuminated this further when she said, in our circumstances today, this fight does not signify, as it did for Mao, something bloodstained and violent, an armed revolution, a class struggle. Non-violence is also a struggle, a greater and more enduring fight. For each individual, this fight starts with oneself, in the present moment, in each particular detail of living. Let us begin by identifying ourselves as Tibetans, for this is our duty. Our effort of daily life, however small, is still a kind of struggle. This last year has seen an unprecedented outpouring of emotion, citizens' journalism, and expression of views by Tibetans and Chinese on the situation in Tibet via blogs and websites. The internet has collapsed physical space and brought Tibetans together in Beijing, where students held a silent vigil to mourn those killed in Tibet, Lhasa, and remote monasteries in the Tibetan countryside that still have access to computers. Many of these Tibetans write in Chinese better than they do Tibetan, and they're representative of a new bilingual, bicultural generation. Unlike the older generation, they did not experience the trauma of the Cultural Revolution. Often they were educated in Chinese cities or schools from middle school onward, and they're aware both of the political struggle being waged in their name and also of something of a renaissance in Tibetan cultural identity. Often the language they use is that of reconciliation. It's not the fiery Free Tibet statements from exiles. We translated into English for a report that I have with me today and which you can pick up as you leave, a collection of writings that is the only known material in Tibetan on the 2008 protests who have been published within China. The magazine, which is called The Eastern Snow Mountain, was quickly banned, but not before copies had circulated in Tibetan areas of Qinghai and Gansu and beyond. And these writings, which I do urge you to read if you can, include insights from inside Tibet on experiences of imprisonment, interrogation, and loss, as well as analytical perspectives on a way forward, indicating an unquenchable spirit and expression of a deeply felt Tibetan identity. One of the writers says, in a year that turned out to be a raging storm, how could we remain in fear? This work is a sketch of history written in the blood of a generation. The essays are grounded in an understanding of the political framework of Chinese policies and law, as well as knowledge about both Chinese and Tibetan culture. I've just returned from Dharamsala in India, the home of the Dalai Lama, where for the first time a group of Chinese people spoke to Tibetans who had gathered at the temple to hear the Dalai Lama's annual March 10th Uprising Day statement. Thousands of Tibetan monks, school children, old grandmothers, others who had just crossed the mountains, firebrand young activists, all listened in rapt attention to these Chinese dissidents as they addressed them as Tibetan brothers and sisters and expressed their support for Tibetan culture. Despite the undoubted force of China's propaganda, there is hope for the future in these new alliances being forged in exile and in China. There is much common ground, not only in terms of shared perceptions and experiences of persecution by the state, but also due to the growing interest of many Chinese in the Dalai Lama and in Tibet's culture. It is also there's a shared ground in the shared importance of Tibet's precious high altitude environment. If you look at a map of Asia, you can clearly see the importance of Tibet in this respect. It's the watershed area for all of China's major rivers. Millions of people in Asia are dependent on Tibet for water. The environment is still an area where Tibetan, Chinese, and Western scholars collaborate with an awareness of the Dalai Lama's key message of our interdependence. Tibet is also described as the Earth's third pole. It's the biggest ice fields outside the Antarctic and the Arctic Circle, and it's also an important barometer for monitoring climate change. Without protecting Tibet's environment and ensuring Tibetan stewardship over the land, there's a bleak future for China as well as Tibet. I'll just wrap up with one. It's in China's interests to find a resolution to the Tibet crisis. And to do so, the Chinese authorities need to stop blaming the Dalai Lama or the BBC or CNN and start engaging with the genuine grievances and sense of dispossession of the Tibetan people. Until Tibetan voices are listened to and taken seriously, no progress will be possible and regional stability will be jeopardized. In Tibetan, as in Chinese culture, remembering those who died and making offerings for them is very important. In many cases since March 2008, Tibetans have not been allowed to mark the deaths of those who were killed, nor have monks been allowed to pray for. I'll close by reading an extract from a blog by the Tibetan writer Wosa. And in this blog, which was written at the time of the Chinese New Year and posted online, Wosa makes a heartfelt appeal for Tibetan cultural traditions to be honored by the Chinese authorities and people. Her words are also a very vivid and passionate reminder of the importance of memory over a forgetting in the quest towards reconciliation. And she wrote this: "Let us light butter lamps to make offerings in memory of the deceased, whose exact number we still do not know, in the corners where video surveillance cannot reach. In our culture and tradition, we attach great importance to the commemoration of the deceased. Even Lenin said that forgetting the past means betrayal. For those of us who believe in religion, forgetting about the deceased means betrayal and signifies that we walk around without any feelings. Cherishing the memory of the deceased is not a virtue unique to any ethnic group. Similarly, the Chinese also deeply cherish the memory of their compatriots who died. I read an article written by a Chinese who suffered in the incident of June the 4th in 1989. He wrote, 'The gunshots smashed all our dreams. How is it possible what is smashed are just dreams of individuals? Our entire ethnic group has a common pain, but because of fear, we even dare not think about the pain or dare not touch the pain. In this way, the pain has been buried in the heart of each one of us year after year. When all our world desires have been satisfied, we ourselves are feeling more and more lost. We have material wealth, but we have lost our soul.' Thank you."
Okay, very much. I'm sure there are questions from the floor. We have about 10 minutes. Yes, there in the back, please.
Hi, Mary Kissel from the Wall Street Journal editorial page. Kate, thanks for your talk. You talked a lot about the repression within the autonomous region. I wondered if you could speak very briefly to how that crackdown on Tibetans has extended to neighboring Nepal.
I've actually just to say again that this is the first time that protests have spread right across Tibet, so all of the Tibetan areas outside the Tibet Autonomous Region as well. I've just been in Kathmandu myself, where I've found that Tibetans are more vulnerable and more scared than I've ever seen them before in my trips going back and forth. The Chinese authorities have been sending numerous delegations to Nepal, and I gather that the Maoist-led government, the Prime Minister Prachandra, is due to make a visit soon to Beijing. He certainly signaled his allegiances when he took over as Prime Minister. The first trip he made was not to New Delhi, but it was to Beijing, where he received a red carpet welcome before the Olympics. In 2005, the Dalai Lama's office and the Tibetan Welfare Office, both crucial to the welfare of Tibetans in Nepal, were both closed down. That was under the King Gyanendra. But now what's happening is even worse. The Prime Minister has signaled that these will not be allowed to be opened again. There has been increasing Chinese influence and interference in the Nepalese judiciary, in the suppression of protests by Tibetan people on the streets of Nepal. Over the past year, as Tibetans have demonstrated in Kathmandu, driven by anguish and anger about the situation of Tibetans across the border, more than 8,000 of them have been detained, mostly released. But certainly the situation in Nepal for the Tibetan people seems to be getting much worse and much more insecure due to the Chinese influence there.
Question over here.
Hi, Kate. It's Guy Newey from AFP. You mentioned that China's actions in Tibet are indicative of an anxiety in their attitude. Do you not think it's, and could another reading not be that it's indicative of their strength and their actions when you look at their attitude to Sarkozy and the pressure that they placed on South Africa and successful pressure they placed on South Africa over the Dalai Lama's visit? Could it not be seen that they're working from a position of strength in their actions in Tibet?
That's a good point. I think you can actually see both. I think that you're right that the Chinese authorities have succeeded to a certain extent in silencing criticism of their human rights record in China. And they've succeeded in subverting international forums on the challenge China's human rights record. I was in Geneva both for the Universal Periodic Review of China's human rights record and also for the Committee Against Torture. And one of the first things that the rapporteurs of the Committee Against Torture asked me was they said that the Chinese delegation there had said that our report on torture in Tibet was insulting to them, and what did I have to say about that? So yes, they are succeeding in subverting, politicizing these international forums, but at the same time, I think the Tibetans themselves, inside Tibet, through their courage and determination, have succeeded in raising the profile of the Tibet issue. For a period last year, it was literally at the top of the international news agenda. And the exceptional thing is that those protests are still continuing. So I think that that both elements are true. The efforts of the Chinese authorities to persuade Chinese people and the rhetoric they use show that they know that people on the international stage are not fully convinced. And just a word about the Dalai Lama too. Even though they did succeed with the blocking of the visa to South Africa, the Dalai Lama is widely acknowledged to have the respect of world leaders across the globe. Despite Chinese pressure, world leaders are not going to they're not going to refuse to meet him. They don't refuse to meet him. We're fully expecting and hoping that there will be a meeting of the new U.S. president with the Dalai Lama when the Dalai Lama is in Washington in October. So despite that rhetoric, I think the Chinese authorities are well aware that in certain ways they're failing to communicate onto that.
Related question to this, there's not just kind of repression, on the other hand, there are also incentives given. Mainly Tibetans getting creative jobs for them, getting certain material kind of rewards for integrating in this type of system, to the point where Han Chinese are migrants are resentful. To what degree is this type of capacity, this kind of peaceful kind of program successful?
I think it's now not successful following the events of last March, because what has happened has been that the crackdown has alienated even the comfortable Tibetan elite, and we're seeing many of the Tibetan elite and intellectuals now speaking out much more about Chinese policies.
Hi, this is James from Bloomberg News. Just one question. In your view, what's the outlook of Tibet in 10 years? Is status quo autonomy or independence, and why? Thank you.
Sorry,
what's the outlook of Tibet in 10 years? Either status quo, autonomy, or independence, and why? Thank you.
Sorry, did you say what was the prospect?
Yeah,
I see. Well, the Dalai Lama for the last 20 years has been seeking a genuine autonomy under the sovereignty of the People's Republic of China. He's been saying that for more than 20 years. Still, the Chinese authorities persist in describing him as a splittist. What the Dalai Lama has reiterated recently is that there's a desperate need for the crackdown to end, for the Tibetan people to be given some sort of space, some sort of measure of genuine autonomy that's consistent with what is outlined in the Chinese constitution. But what we've seen is that amendments to the regional ethnic autonomy law in China itself have actually undermined Tibetan religion and culture instead of helping to protect it. So unless there's some shift within the party towards acknowledging Tibetan concerns and seeing the peaceful dissent as an opportunity to learn more about the extent of Tibetan loss and Tibetan grievances after 50 years, then there is little prospect for the future. So I think that the debate is about autonomy, and it's about protecting Tibetan cultural identity.
Paul Harris, when you're talking to me, you are preaching to the converted on the Tibetan cause, and I suspect I'm not the only one in this forum, but this is a very untypical forum for Hong Kong. I've lived here for 14 years, and I've been very struck by how people who are well-informed on other topics have swallowed the official Beijing propaganda about Tibet, and I'd like to know what you think can be done about that, and I'd specifically like to ask whether on this visit or any other planned visits, you plan to visit any of the Hong Kong universities and take part in debate on these issues.
Thank you, Paul. On the Hong Kong universities, this trip was arranged at relatively short notice, so I hadn't had a chance to do that, but it's a very good idea. And in terms of moving forward beyond China's propaganda, I think the real work on this is being done by Tibetans and Chinese themselves. As I say, I was just in Dharamsala in India, where more and more of this young Tibetan generation who also speak Chinese are engaging in dialogue with Chinese in China via the internet, via blogs, is where change must come from talking between Tibetans and Chinese and discovering that common ground. As I mentioned in my talk, the environment is one of the issues. Tibet's environment is of key significance to China, to China's future. That's an area where there could genuinely be meaningful debate and moving forward. 30 years ago, the Dalai Lama was talking about the importance of the environment and awareness of global interdependence in a way that didn't even mention politics. So there are some ways in which the issues can be talked about without even mentioning politics. In Dharamsala, there are numerous Tibetans who are also engaged pretty much full-time in working with Chinese people. Some of the Chinese visitors to Dharamsala when I was there, there was one young Chinese woman who left her camera and her money carefully locked up in a hotel safe before she went out into the streets in Dharamsala. And she said that it was because she'd been told that she would be probably mugged and beaten up by Tibetans the minute she ventured out of her hotel. And she found that that wasn't the case at all, and that the Tibetans welcomed the Chinese to speak about the issues of mutual concern. And I think in this report we include some of the writings of Tibetan scholars who are working with some of the Chinese. So while this is taking some time to sort of to filter to higher levels, and it's been jeopardized by the very strident nationalist propaganda from the state itself, I think it still offers hope for the future. Just to mention one point, actually, in relation to your question, there's a report that we have on our website called Tracking the Steel Dragon, which any of you can download, which talks about the impact of China's economic policies on Tibetan areas. And it mentions the issue of Chinese migration to Tibetan areas. In fact, Chinese migrants have, and urban dwellers have benefited more from China's economic policies than Tibetans themselves, who are a rapidly growing and demoralized underclass. But there's more detail in that report.
Thank you. Francis?
Francis Moriarty, RTHK. Kate, your organization is called the International Campaign for Tibet. And I have two questions. I'd like to know what it is exactly you perceive yourself campaigning for. Can you hear me now? Your organization is called the International Campaign for Tibet. So my two questions are, first, what exactly do you perceive yourself as campaigning for? And secondly, do you agree that there may be, as Tibet seems to have some hold on the Western imagination, is there a Richard Gere, Shangri-La notion of Tibet that really is at odds with what the reality was for many years under a feudal theocracy, and that in fact people are at least materially better off today than they may have been, say, at least pre-40 down?
We are called the International Campaign for Tibet. In some ways, it's a misnomer, because we're much more about monitoring and advocacy work on the situation in Tibet, and very broadly, we're supporting the Dalai Lama's call for a genuine autonomy, so that Tibetans can preserve their unique cultural identity, and we do so by monitoring the situation in Tibet and passing that information on to governments and media, as well as some grassroots activism as well. But an important part of our work is also Chinese outreach, and we employ a number of Tibetan Chinese speakers who are working with universities, academic forums, with groups of Chinese dissidents and scholars and so on, in order to communicate what's happening in Tibet. So in terms of the situation pre-1949, I think that what the Chinese authorities fail to acknowledge in their propaganda about the feudal serfdom and theocracy, depicting Tibetans as backward, is that both the 14th Dalai Lama, this current Dalai Lama, and the 13th Dalai Lama before him, were both reformers, and both seeking to modernize socialism is inaccurate when applied to Tibet before 1949, although undoubtedly there were injustices and undoubtedly there was poverty, as there was in many other areas in Asia, of Asia, and still is today. But there's no doubt that Tibet would have developed and was developing, just as other areas of Asia have developed. But the problem with the policies now is that China is imposing economic reform through the model. It's imposing it from the top down. It's based on an urban industrial model, which is inappropriate for an area which is overwhelmingly rural. 85% of Tibetans live in rural areas, in the sort of vast grasslands that dominate the Tibetan landscape. And yet China is seeking to impose policies based around developing the urban areas. And what we've seen is that the main beneficiaries of these policies have been the urban dwellers, which are in the main Chinese settlers and Chinese migrants coming to find work. Tibetans literally can't compete with the Chinese settlers. Research which is published actually in official Chinese data shows that the average Sichuan peasant who comes to Lhasa for work is actually better educated to a higher degree than a Tibetan. Levels of rural-urban inequality in Tibetan areas are higher than anywhere else in China, and that's according to Chinese official statistics. Levels of illiteracy in the Tibet Autonomous Region are also higher than most other areas of the PRC. So the economic reforms and change are not benefiting Tibetans, nor are they allowing the area to develop fully.
One or two last questions. Bonnie, you had one?
Yes, mine is very brief. I had the pleasure of studying with the Dalai Lama's brother at my university in the Midwest of the United States in the 60s in graduate school, and that was at a time when apparently the Chinese were not watching what was being said by people in the United States about Tibet. My professors told me a great deal about the history of Tibet over a couple thousand years and the back and forth between China and Tibet and who ruled whom over all these centuries. So I just wondered if you had one recommendation of a book for people to read that would actually encapsulate this enormously long and complex history between China and Tibet to educate themselves.
Probably the history in the last 50 years only would be Dragon in the Land of Snows by Professor Seng Shakya, who's one of the leading Tibetan scholars and historians. My Land and My People is the Dalai Lama's autobiography, which is also good for an understanding. And I suggest, yes, I think those would be the two recommendations.
A question from Frank Jing down here.
I just want to follow up on Francis's question. You said the 13th and 14th Dalai Lamas were reformers, and in 1949, Tibet was no longer a feudal society. Is that right? In 1949, Tibet was no longer a feudal society.
It's described by the Chinese as a feudal society.
It's described by you, not a feudal society. Had slavery been abolished in 1949?
There was no systematic slavery in Tibet before 1949. And the system, it is true that there was poverty and injustice. And there was a system which various analysts and historians have described as something similar to, sometimes people were tied to the land, it's true, but often they could buy their way out of those ties in a way that was different from the common understanding of feudalism. But there was no systematic slavery at all.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for coming here and telling us interesting things about a part of China we unfortunately don't know much firsthand. So the best thing, of course, would be if travel restrictions for journalists or the public in general would be lifted, so we could take a first point, kind of point of view ourselves. Saying this, you never let go anybody without a present from the FCC.
Thank you very much
for coming here. Bye-bye.
Sorry, can I just add, I think Kate has copies of her report if you wanted to copy.
Yep.